Beaming out across the galaxy, this is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. I hope you all are ready for a wilder ride tonight. I say wilder because, boy, that debacle of a debate was something wild right on its own right. And I'm just going to mention this at the top of the show and then drop it, folks. But obviously nothing of importance was ever said in this debate. And even still, you know, it looked like Trump probably won the competition. But who cares, right? Who wants either one of these people in power? And that's the whole point. So I see that things are going exactly as I expected. And even how bizarre it was that the ABC hosts of the debate were mentioning the divide in the public's eye, that whoever won the presidential election, the other half would believe they got shorted and that they would not go along with whoever gets elected. So there's this big divide in the country. This is exactly as I expected it to happen. They even ended the debate on that very topic with the candidates themselves saying, would you support this other person if they win? It's as if they're writing it into the script, as they are. And I mean, if you want to see how much they're writing it into the script, just look how much time they spent talking about the birther debate. Okay. Now, you know, if you want to get my thoughts and theories and predictions and understandings on how all of this is playing out, go to freemantv.com and check out guest appearances. This is where I show up on other people's programs and give all my thoughts and theories on things. What I love to do with this program is bring on amazing people that are going to bring you the most mind-boggling information that goes along with this. So as we look into the strange divide that is our debacle of a debate in our presidential elections and see how Putin seems to be the better character for our president, they're going to start naming us all as communists, folks. I see that coming with the whole Trump-Putin connections going on. But what we don't realize is that there is a much, much bigger picture in this situation that has nothing to do with economics or business or the state of the nation, but has everything to do with our ancient past. And this has been the mystery that has been hidden from mankind for, well, all of existence of our current civilization. We can't possibly understand the ancient structures from the past, why they were built. I mean, and at this moment, we have ISIS destroying ancient Babylon, getting rid of all the ancient structures that would give us any clues to why this stuff even existed. U.S. military is going into Baghdad during Shock and Awe, stealing ancient artifacts out of the museum. Now we have things like Göbekli Tepe coming up to the surface, showing super ancient mankind civilization. We look at things like the Colossi of Memnon and we see Queen Tee standing there as some giant over humanity. And we have to wonder, folks, we have to look and start to concern ourselves with this ancient history that has every bit to play into the storyline of our current civilization. So realize that the Egyptians believed that fish people and serpent people came together to create humanity. They called them the Ogdoad. Realize that there are structures on the planet that just are boggling our minds for millennia. Things like the Great Pyramids. We would never build that today, would we? Oh, there's no purpose. We do not understand the purpose of it. And once you start to understand the precision that was put into placing it where it is, the understanding of how much effort would go into building such a thing, and how it's actually physically impossible in the 21st century to recreate that structure, that's when you start to ask these questions. But everywhere around the globe, the Incas put their main astronomically aligned temples on land that was completely uninhabitable by mankind. Why? When we look to even Native Americans using Chaco Canyon as an astronomical device, we wonder why. And then, as you discover, each of these civilizations have some universal connection to the star Sirius, you gotta ask why. So this is the bizarre world that we actually live in that is being quickly cloaked in front of our eyes. And we need to dig deep into understanding why these structures exist. Now, we will dedicate 20 plus miles to a Large Hadron Collider, or even 50 miles if you're in China building the biggest collider in the world. And you can imagine sometime, well, even right now, we don't have any idea why. Why are we devoting that? And you'll see how this Large Hadron Collider technology and what we're going to discuss with our ancient past come together, and why I would bring these together as we talk with Tom Montauk. And that is spelled M-O-N-T-A-L-K, like talk, like you're talking, just so you don't get that confused with the T-O-T-A-U-K. So anyway, Tom Montauk is our guest tonight, and he's author, researcher, and a musician, a man that I would say is a brother from another mother, getting deep into esoteric wisdom, technical knowledge of this, which is so critical, folks. You can't just go around pointing it out. You really need to understand it. He has published works in extensive and an extensive website that really gives you the fringe knowledge for beginners, which is the title of his book. Fringe Knowledge for Beginners and Discerning Alien Disinformation. This also is very critical to our understanding. You can get all his information and his books there at montauk.net. That's M-O-N-T-A-L-K.net. And you want to dig deep. It's an amazing site. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hey, Freeman. Thanks for having me on.
It is a great pleasure to talk with somebody that is getting deep into this story, because this is one that just gets left out of the loop. And I've always felt this was so critical from the very first time I started talking to people, that we have to understand our ancient past in order to understand what the heck's going on in our current civilization. Don't you think this is true?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, history... See, I didn't used to study history too much, but over time I definitely found just how necessary it is. And the reason, of course, is because the past, the present, and the future form a continuum. So if you study one part, it can tell us something about the other part. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? So I'm interested in history because it can tell us not only about how we got here, but most importantly, where we're going. One example would be the alien factor, which is absolutely huge, not only in the past, but... And everything that's happening now and what's coming up as well. I'd go so far as to say that if it weren't for alien genetic engineering, we probably wouldn't be around today in the form that we are, you know, whether we would be greater beings or lesser beings. In a way, it's kind of both, you know.
Well, let me throw in, folks, just so you think this through, that the last presidential debate that I was watching with Dennis Kucinich, and you can watch this in my video, they absolutely brought up the extraterrestrial situation only to laugh at poor Kucinich about reporting a UFO. And you can see clearly that that's a puzzle they don't want anyone looking at. Right, Tom?
Yeah, Tuck. I mean, it's just crazy the amount of skepticism and ridicule that the subject has gotten. But you see, here's the interesting thing. There seems to be a dual thing going on where, on the one hand, they're ridiculing it publicly, you know, towards the mainstream, the people that are propping up the Matrix control system, the ones that are, you know, pumping up the economy and everything. To them, they're kind of diminishing the subject. Whereas at the same time, if you look at some of these insiders that have been releasing information about the alien presence and all that, I think part of that information release might actually be condoned by, you know, certain elements of that very same power structure. So in a way, they're kind of like lying to one side, and they're drip feeding truth mixed with disinformation to the fringe elements in a way to, you know, control both sides of the opposition there.
Oh my God.
I just wanted to throw that out.
Yeah, we had those amazing moments where the Pope, back when it was Pope Benedict, saying... Well, actually, it was the new Pope, wasn't it? Saying that he would baptize E.T. no matter how many tentacles he had. I mean, we had the Pope saying that E.T. is real, the Big Bang happened, and all of this is true. And yet the public still ridicules. The Royal Society gathered together every great mind on the subject and brought them together on a special discussion on what to do when we do make contact with extraterrestrials. And so we can see clearly that there, I mean, the Royal Society, that's no joke, folks. This is the leading edge of scientific discussion. And here they are with a major, you can go look it online, their major discussion on extraterrestrial life. And we've got even Hillary pictured running around with Davy's book, Are We Alone? Paul Davy's book. So, yes, it's on their minds, right, Tom?
Yeah, it is. And I think the reason is because they're trying to prepare for a timeline that is ultimately beyond their control, you know, which is being decided by certain alien powers about when they're going to implement certain parts of their agenda. And so, you know, they're trying to scramble and figure out, okay, well, how best do we keep control of the cattle, so to speak, when the storm is approaching? And, you know, I think they've come up with different plans for it. I remember back in the 2000s, the first decade, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it used to be the plan where they're going to sell aliens as being nothing but our brothers, you know, all positive, we should welcome them with open arms. And there were certain key opinion leaders being put on the stage to kind of tout that sort of paradigm. But after enough people started coming forward with pretty good evidence and information that aliens might not be here in our best interests, then right around 2009 and so on, I noticed that the plan shifted. You know, at that point, different types of media things started coming out. Like we had movies like The Fourth Kind. We had the V miniseries that got rebooted. And eventually had people like Stephen Hawking coming out, right, saying we shouldn't
contact E.T.
Yeah, or if we do, then prepare for them to squash us, right? Now, yes. Michio Kaku, right? He was trying to compare us as like Bambi to what, Godzilla or something like that. He used that popular term there. You know, basically trying to say we better watch out because aliens might be more than we can handle. You know, and he's also drawing comparisons to first contact with, like, you know, the Europeans first meeting the natives in America, right?
Yep.
Trying to say that first contact doesn't always go well. And those particular points were points that, you know, 5 years prior were only heard in the more aware aspects of the fringe community. You know, because at that time, everyone was saying, no, aliens are awesome. They're here. We should all welcome them. And then there was a small minority, one of which was myself, you know, and that's why I put out that book, Discerning Alien Disinformation, because I had scanned pretty much the entire alien literature out there, you know, from abduction literature, contactee stuff, you know, to books like How to Invite Alien Contact into Your Life for Your Benefit, which was a bunch of disinformation. And I discovered the patterns that were being used to sell this false narrative to the public. And I laid it all out in my article. So you can go to my article, you can see what all the points were. And I just totally dissected it. And, you know, and I'm sure that played a very small role in possibly even shifting the plan that they were going to implement, because now with this information being out, you know, they couldn't just get away with what they're doing. So, you know, what we see nowadays is more the whole alien invasion scenario that they're touting, which is like, you know, aliens could invade and, you know, we should rely on our black ops military, you know, G.I. Joe kind of stuff to fight them off one day. But in the end, it leads to the same outcome, which is an eventual alien empire kind of thing coming out into the open with a black ops / you know, hybrid human elite serving as the intermediate proxies over the population. And then, of course, Earth then becomes more like another energy farm or resource planet or something like that, which is, I think, what they planned for quite a long time.
Absolutely. You know, folks, this is the greater plan, you see. So if you're not bringing this into your puzzle and you're just trying to work out geopolitics, you're missing a huge piece. But, you know, this is a piece that is unreachable. We can't know the extraterrestrial mind. But those of us like myself and Tom who have actually had encounters, you know, I'm always left, Tom, with this yearning. After having two major encounters with inexplicable UFO situations and even losing time, I'm left now yearning. I'm left staring off into the stars, waiting for that next encounter. And I think people get a little frustrated because they're not the quote-unquote lucky ones to see these things. Do you want to share any of the things that led you up into this paranormal understanding?
Well, yeah, when I was a kid, I had various experiences that at the time Because when, you know, when you're a kid, you don't really question too many things sometimes. You just think, okay, well, this is how the world works. It's pretty weird, but I guess that's just how it is, right? And you don't find out until later that that's not how it is for most people. So when I was ages 2, 3, 4, I would have abductions pretty much on a monthly basis. And the weird thing is, like, whenever the abductions would be over, my memory then would be suppressed, and I would kind of go back to my regular mode. And it's only when they would start up again that all of a sudden I'd realize, you know, at the very beginning phase of it, like, oh crap, this has happened so many times before, and here they come again, you know. And, you know, the way it would usually play out is that, you know, it'd be about 2, 3 p.m. in the afternoon, you know, sun coming in through the window. And I'd be in my mom's bedroom, and she would be there, and she would tell me, like, Thomas, you know, because this was in Germany, I was German at the time. She told me, Thomas, stay there. I have to attend to some business out in the hallway. So she'd go out the door into the hallway, and I could hear all this activity going on out there. It's almost like when you're at a busy party, but you're in a room alone by yourself, you can hear all this stuff going on in the rest of the apartment. Well, it was kind of like that, except for an audible. It was just more like psychic noise. I could pick up on the grays being out there, you know, maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen of them. And at that point, I knew what was going to happen next, and I'd run into the corner and cower down just to say would open the door and stream in, you know, a dozen at a time. And of course, by the time they reached me, I would black out at that point or lose consciousness. And I would only have a few fragments of memories after that, you know, such as floating out from the balcony, you know, this was like six stories up in the air, I think, towards the ship and being taken somewhere, you know, landing in this grassy area where the sun was setting. And I assume that must have been Eastern Europe, maybe Western Russia, because the time zone difference, right? It was like right around 5 or 6 p.m. at the time because the sun was setting. So it must have been 3-4 time zones to the east. But anyway, point being that I had that experience. I've had, you know, demonic ghost encounters when I was a kid. And, you know, that left me with a lot of questions. I wanted to figure out what the heck was going on. And my dad at the time, he was an engineer working for Siemens as an x-ray technician. Anyway, he was really into science. He was kind of a nerd, so he would always teach me about science, and I'd have all these questions, and he would always answer them. So I was kind of inculcated with this idea that the world is really fascinating, and I need to figure things out. So when you match that up with these alien experiences and these ghost experiences, it's like cognitive dissonance, you know, what the heck is going on? And so that kind of set the stage where I did my best, you know, starting age 12 and 13 to read everything I could on it, try to unravel the mystery, and, you know, I read all the Sitchin books and Whitley Strieber stuff, metaphysics, everything in my local library about these subjects. And then as time went on, I started networking with more people, and I started putting out a website to get more feedback. So Montauk.net, at that domain name, it came out in 2001 and 2002. And since that time, it's been pretty much nonstop trying to figure out these mysteries. So, yeah, so over time, I got into alchemy, into Gnosticism, of course, the alien stuff, and, you know, metaphysics, scalar physics, longitudinal waves, everything that eventually coalesced into a kind of meta paradigm, as this meta picture of what might be going on if you take all this data into account. So what I like to talk about on the show kind of ties into that, because, you know, if you look at the genetic evidence for alien intervention, if you match that up with ancient accounts of the sky people or the gods walking among men and, you know, flying around in chariots of fire, and if you match that up with, like, megalithic sites that are simply impossible to build with the human technology at the time, if you match that up with accounts of supernatural technologies like the Ark of the Covenant or, you know, the various Chintamani magical stones that gave off radiation and made people sick and electrocuted them and so on, well, all of that matches right on up with what we know in modern times about UFOs, alien and the abduction program, collaborations between, like, black ops military and alien factions, and, of course, what eyewitnesses themselves have said about what alien technology can do. So it all fits together, it all meshes, and one part supports the other. So the more, you know, the wider you diversify your field of study, the clearer and the more coalescing the picture then becomes. So by examining the anomalies in history, the secret forces and the controllers of ancient times, and in looking at the technology that they had and what forces that they were collaborating with, well, it may be possible to get a clearer picture of what's going on today and therefore what might happen in the future. So therefore, I'd like to talk about some anomalies, including this idea of the ancient global mariners, which was a seafaring civilization that spanned the entire globe, who had access to certain what seems to be alien technologies. And, you know, I'd also like to talk about the Ark of the Covenant, the origin of the Israelites. I want to touch on that. And also I want to touch on the Holy Grail and the Philosopher's Stone and how these are all examples of what I have come to call, quote-unquote, demiurgic technologies, which I'll explain that term. And what these technologies are is they're none other than devices that employ occult and hyperdimensional energies and principles in their operation, and not just the regular, you know, physical forces that we know in engineering nowadays. So, yeah, I'm going to touch on all that if I can.
Fantastic. I love a university man that knows how to lay out his thesis. I'm well trained in TRIT, and you are doing a good job. So, yes, I want to get into all those things, too. Well, the Mariners. I mean, let's go ahead. I started my career on fish people, and this whole concept that is constantly put around us of ancient mariners and the ideas that there was a global civilization, folks. You can't deny it. We find their trademarks left on every continent. So, Tom, please, if that's the best place to begin, then start there. But wherever you need to begin, go with it.
Yeah, the ancient global mariners idea, that's pretty fascinating because, right, because we're taught that, you know, when you're taught in school that the first voyage around the world, according to conventional history, was it was Magellan in 1519 AD. So, and it took his crew 3 years to make this trip around the world. So the interesting thing about that is that 3 years, if that is a figure about how long it takes to go around the world, then you find this figure also in other ancient sources. For example, we have the Old Testament, 1 Kings chapter 10, where it's said that King Solomon had a fleet of ships, you know, the ships known as the ships of Tarshish. And they would come to port every 3 years and unload precious metals and exotic goods and exotic animals, okay? That's one example. Another example is Herodotus mentioning that the Phoenician mariners were known for sailing around Africa and beyond and returning after 3 years. And they would come back with tales that he simply couldn't believe because they're actually visiting countries that Herodotus at the time didn't even know of. Because, you know, this idea of traveling the entire globe was kind of kept a secret. It was, you know, call it matters of national security in a way, because they had access to the riches of the entire globe and they wanted to keep that a secret. So, you know, global trade routes were a very protected kind of knowledge because it was access to almost infinite wealth at the time.
Real quick, that brought up the concept of gold for me. I mean, this is one of the, for me, would be the key ingredient for people to realize that there was some alien intervention in the past, because why on earth would humans start digging into the ground for this shiny object? It doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, obviously it's at the heart of civilization today. And no one ever asked the question, why gold? Why are people mining gold? But now we're colliding gold particles at the relativistic heavy ionic collider in folding space-time. So maybe we have some more ideas. I want also to mention that you can't go into space without gold, folks. But, you know, do you have that into your account?
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is, you know, what we know about the metals or, you know, just elements in general, it's only like it's only a 2D representation of basically a four-dimensional object in a way. You know, we only have a shadow of the true reality of what elements actually are. And, you know, just like our own bodies, right? We have the physical component, but as all mystics know, we also have an etheric and an astral, or whatever you want to call it, subtle energy component. So the same thing can be said of the elements, where gold, copper, you know, gold and copper especially, you know, maybe silver too, but gold and copper seem to have special applications on the etheric or hyperdimensional level, which other metals might not as much. Like iron, for example. You know, in Irish legend, right, there's this idea that you can ward off, you know, certain fairies and certain evil spirits using a horseshoe. Why? Because it's iron, and these supernatural entities seem to have problems dealing with iron. And the reason why that is because iron has a very magnetic draw to etheric energy. So it draws etheric energy into itself. And so if you're near it, it tends to suck it out of you, right? So it's kind of funny that we're surrounded by all this iron. We have this iron age, the Industrial Revolution and everything. You know, we're surrounded by iron. And I think that's one of those control mechanisms being used to control us on an etheric level. But yeah, but going back to the point of gold and copper, You know, gold was one of the first metals ever to be mined, and copper was another one of those ones as well. And I think it's because at the time, not only were people more in tune with etheric, so, you know, they kind of knew the etheric properties of different elements, but of course aliens knew that as well, and, you know, there were these alien factions that were using humans as slave labor to mine these materials, so.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, think on that one, folks. Just, you know, keep that one in mind as you go about your day to day, that there is far more to that. I mean, simple thing right there. You know, you ask why there's 60 seconds or 360 degrees, you're going to find some bizarre answers when you get to the end of that. And I wanted to throw in a little tidbit of fact on iron. There, out in front of New Delhi in India, there's an iron column there that stands, you know, stories tall and goes deep into the earth. It supposedly spears the head of the serpent at the base there. But the thing of it is, there's no way they could have made this iron column. And in all its millennia of existence, it never rusted until now. And I really believe that's due to all of our pollution. But here is an iron column standing there that defies modern logic, because there's no way that they had technology to make an iron column that big. It is there to do exactly what Tom is saying, to dispel these evil spirits and pierce the head of the serpent. And, you know, the only place we know that iron doesn't rust is on the moon. So,
yeah, well, the funny thing about that is... you know, serpent, there's many things associated with that term, including ley lines, you know, the subterranean telluric energies. And, you know, that's this energy grid around the Earth. It has certain key nodal points, right? It's just like the chakras. So if you can access where those points are and you put, let's say, an iron column there, it's probably going to have a similar or, you know, possibly even opposite effect as a column made of stone, you know, like the obelisks in Egypt, which probably served a similar function, but, you know, towards different ends, possibly. So, I'll quickly mention on that point that I was looking at some ancient maps. I was looking at the Piri Reis map and some other maps, and I noticed that they had these points on there, which were part of a grid system based on the Platonic solids. And one of the points was aligned to Cairo, Egypt, you know, near the Great Pyramid. And, you know, the map was only a fragment, right? So I put in Google Earth and I wrote a Python script to, you know, overlay a Platonic solid upon the entire globe. And funny enough, the other point lines up in Paris. And what do we have in Paris? We have the Eiffel Tower, a giant iron structure located at one of those nodal points, right? So, you know, someone obviously knows how to manipulate the...
Somebody knows something, that's for sure. And folks, every one of these people is a Freemason. I'm just throwing that in there. Eiffel, you know, absolutely. And then we look at the street plans of D.C. What do you think that's all about? Come on. There's no reason for these things, and that's what you got to figure out. There is a reason. And so getting into the metaphysical, as Tom has, talking about these ideas on a spiritual plane is more relevant than the idea of thinking that they just spent millions of dollars to put pentagrams in the street plans of Washington, D.C., or to build a Freemasonic structure like the Eiffel Tower. Okay, so please fill us in here, Tom, because I'm dying to get deeper and deeper into this. Let's take it on back and bring it forward.
Okay, yeah, so going back in time then, we were talking about metals and how these ancient mariners were mining metals at the time, you know, not only gold, but also copper. So, yeah, the funny thing, as you know, some people listening probably know if they've read the material on it, but North and South America were being regularly visited by mariners from Europe, you know, from Africa, and from Asia as well, you know, depending on the time in history. But primarily, it was these ones from Europe that I'm talking about now, like Southeastern Europe, Turkey, Asia Minor, that area. So during the Bronze Age, there was like massive, massive copper mining going on in Upper Michigan, you know, starting around 3500 BC. And archaeologists, you know, they have found somewhere between 5 and 10,000 copper mines in the area. And they estimate that around 500,000 tons of copper were being mined. And okay, so this was 3500 BC in Michigan, when, according to conventional archaeology, right, there's only Native Americans up there. The problem is, barely any of that copper exists among Native American artifacts. Whereas in Europe, in the Middle East, you know, there are more bronze artifacts then can be accounted for by the copper availability in those regions. Okay, so obviously the copper there in Europe, the Middle East, was being taken from from North America, amongst other places, and the copper was mixed with tin to create bronze, which was a lot harder than copper. So it's pretty obvious that those who ran the bronze industry back then, they were making trips to Michigan and other places like Cornwall in England to get their copper and tin to make the bronze. Now, the other curious thing is that the ancient megalithic sites that are found wherever these global mariners went, there's a correlation between the two. So where you find the megaliths is where you find these mariners. So they are the ones who seem to have that technology. These megalithic sites, they're positioned all along the global trade routes. So, I'm talking about places like megalithic sites in India, Indonesia, Japan, Easter Island, Bolivia and Peru, Egypt, Greece, Italy, England, and Ireland. Those are some of the major megalithic sites you'll find if you look them up. And all of these sites display similar masonry methods for a given time period in history. And so what it appears is that these mariners, they were living out a tradition that went back thousands of years, possibly, to around 5,000 or 6,000 BC, if not even earlier. And as time went on and as their civilization would rise and fall, they would keep revisiting these sites and they would keep rebuilding or building atop of, what their ancestors had left there. So, so from what I can tell, their civilization, it would build up into a global power until a cataclysm would nearly wipe them out. That was a repeating pattern there. And then there would be a dark age as they survived and rebuilt. And then after some time, they would build back up to a global power again. And every time they did this, they would resume the trade routes that their ancestors had established. And then they would use some of the same knowledge and the same technology. The only difference is that the knowledge and the technology would actually degrade over time, as you would expect. I mean, you can't hold on to that kind of stuff forever, necessarily. So they would lose pieces of it. And so what you typically find in places like Easter Island or Egypt or Peru is that the oldest megalithic masonry there, it has the largest stones put together with the greatest precision. While the additions made hundreds or 1,000 years later, they were precise, but they were not as large. And then eventually when the natives, who lacked any of that knowledge, tried to build on those ruins, then that's where you get these walls with, these really crappy, irregular stones fitted together with hammer and chisel in a really crude way. Okay, but you can look at these megaliths, the different layers and the different styles of it built at different times, and you can figure out what technology was being used and what was lost as time went on, So I'll give you an example of that. We've got the megalithic walls in Cusco, Peru, for example. And if you don't remember what they look like giant marshmallows squished together and kind of shaved down. It's pretty amazing. I went out and bought some modeling clay and I cut them into the shape of natural stones as you would find like boulders. And then I merely set them atop one another and I squished them together, from all sides. And what it ended up looking like was exactly like those stones in Cusco, Peru. So I highly doubt that they carved them into that shape. I think they soften them somehow and they squish them together.
I want to throw in a little tidbit. There is actually a depiction there in the Inca work where there's this little astronaut looking guy who has a blower of some sort that's spraying out a cloud. And it's believed that this was the technology used to do exactly that, soften those rocks. And then we have Coral Castle to deal with in our modern days, but not in the same concept, but still in the same ideas of these megalithic structures. But yeah, there are these ancient depictions, and that's why I wanted to also mention that ISIS was destroying all these ancient depictions so that we can't find a lot of these secrets. But you look at that 33 angles on a rock with no room even for a piece of paper to slide through. I'm right there with you, Tom.
Yeah. So in order to construct these, you have to have a specialized suite of technologies, that have a certain number of functions, okay? You need something to levitate the stones. You need something to soften them. You need something to cut really precise flat surfaces and edges. And you need something like a plasma torch or blower to cut holes and to cut channels, which may be what was depicted in that thing that you referenced. So, you know, all of these you see being used in the oldest megalithic sites. But if you say, for example, if you look at what if the technology to levitate and soften the stones was lost, but then other techs still functioned, like, then what you would have instead is smaller stones that could be transported by human strength, but they would still be cut and fit with laser precision, which is exactly what you see in the Inca Temple of the Sun, for example, which wasn't built by the Incas, of course, as the Incas came later. But the point being that it was built by people with advanced technology, but they were only using half of the toolbox, so to speak. That's why they didn't have huge stones in that temple. Or if they did have huge stones, they were building atop the huge stone foundation stones that were laid there by their ancestors, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years earlier. Anyway, so to get an idea of when these things were built, you know, because I'm really curious about like where all this happened and how it fit into the timeline of history. Well, there are these megaliths in Japan that are actually pretty interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that there were megaliths in Japan, but it turns out there's quite a number of them, including the wall that the Imperial Palace there is built on. It was a wall that wasn't built by the Japanese, but it was really ancient. And the walls there, you know, they're built with exactly the same style as what you find elsewhere, like in Peru, for example. Now, the interesting thing about those is that these stones, like a lot of these other stones around the world, they included the use of metal clamps to hold them together. You know, they're shaped like a T or like an I or like an X. And so what happens is they would take these two stones, they would put them together, they would carve a little channel between where they meet, and then pour molten metal into it, and then that would form a clamp that would hold them together. So, interestingly, the clamps that were used in the ones in Japan, I wasn't able to find out what the ones in other countries were made of, but the ones used in Japan, they were made of copper. Okay, they're not made of bronze, they're made of copper. So you have stone, and you have copper being used. That is what you would expect to find in the Chalcolithic Age, meaning the Copper Age, because, you know, chalco comes from chalco, which is a Greek word meaning copper, and then lithos means stone. So we're talking about the Copper Age here when that wall in Japan was built. And the copper, the interesting thing about copper is it first arose somewhere around 7500 BC, and, you know, up until about 4500 BC when the first bronze started to appear. So that's the time frame that we're looking at. And the interesting thing is that copper, when it was first developed for use, it was developed in Syria, well, what is today Syria and Turkey, and the areas around the Black Sea. And that also happens to be where sites like Göbekli Tepe exist, or that underground city called Derinkuyu, right? If you ever watched Ancient Aliens, they featured that city in there. Anyway, yeah, the Derinkuyu, that's the underground prehistoric megalithic complex that could house as many as 20,000 people, you know. And why were all these people living underground? Well, obviously, it's because either they were escaping something on the surface, or they were hiding out from a mass cataclysm, right? Just as the elites are doing nowadays with their underground bases. So the funny thing is history repeats itself, and maybe the people back then knew that a cataclysm was coming, and they, or maybe their alien benefactors, built these underground cities to house them.
Yeah,
but anyway,
that's a question I had always had was, you know, spending so much effort to build astronomically aligned temples to watch long periods of time. I mean, we're talking 26 to 50,000 years of time watched by these structures. What do they know? What, you know, what is bringing about the cyclical catastrophes that then leave the next generation kind of bumbling with the technology? I don't expect you to have that answer, because no one would yet until the catastrophe happens again. But we have to consider the fact that building temples astronomically aligned is there to monitor long periods of time.
Yeah, I mean, any civilization that is global and that spans a very, very long period of time, they're going to be interested in what happens to the Earth over a long period of time, because they're going to be affected by it, right? It's not like I don't know, some small society that kind of gets wiped out and then they rebuild, but they forget all the previous knowledge and they go through this repeating cycle of losing everything. If you're smart enough, and if you have the resources and you have the wealth, then you're going to know what's going to happen and you're going to prepare for it, because that's the only way that you can build up control and wealth and everything over vast eons, which is what these ancient mariners and their descendants have been doing, you know, since pretty much the dawn of modern history. Yeah, so the question is, who were these mariners and where did they exist and so on? That's what I've been trying to figure out over the past 5 years, you know, when I started researching the subject. So I mentioned Syria, Turkey, and the Black Sea area. And so with that, we're starting to zero in on where the megalithic global mariners first originated. Okay, now we're taught in schools, right, that the Sumerians and Mesopotamia were the first civilization, but that's actually not true, and that's outdated knowledge. Even going by conventional archaeology, there were people known as the Vincas, V-I-N-C-A-S, who were already a sophisticated culture by 5700 BC. So that's almost 8,000 years ago, and you know they had culture, they had art, they had pretty sophisticated pottery. And you know the thing about pottery is, it's not just taking clay and sticking it in a campfire. You have to have a certain level of technology to even produce the kilns that make temperatures high enough to create, you know, this level of pottery, which is what these Vincas had. And the other interesting thing is, once you get to that level of temperature, that's when you start realizing that you can melt metal out of ore. So with the invention of that kind of level of pottery, those very same people would have also discovered metals. And so that's the reason why that area is also home to the origins of copper metallurgy, for example, and later on bronze. So that's why these people were the originators of the Bronze Age, because you know they had all the precedent in terms of tools, you know, like the kilns and everything like that, in order to produce these hot fires to, you know, melt the metals and everything. So fire was very, very important to them. And it's quickly worth mentioning that, of course, where else do you find fire being very important? You find it in Vedic civilization. So in Hinduism, you know, fire has a very important ritualistic role, more so than in other religions, because the Vedics, the Hindus, they're Indo-European, basically. It's an Indo-European language, Sanskrit is, and their religion kind of traces back to Indo-European roots. And I'll get into that later when I talk about what happened to these Indo-Europeans. But yeah, the point being that it was the descendants of these people in southeastern Europe around the Black Sea area who, you know, starting around 5500 BC or so, they spread down into Turkey and then down the Tigris and Euphrates River to colonize Mesopotamia, which is what is nowadays Iraq, okay? So it was these people who I think should be called Proto-Indo-Europeans, because they came before Indo-European language even existed. It was these people originally from the Black Sea who I think founded this global empire, probably under alien direction to some degree. I mean, it's hard to say. I'm still researching that part. But yeah. So later on, you know, they would spur on the Bronze Age. But even before that, you know, even before that, they were navigating the globe and building various megalithic structures. So if you look at archaeology, going back quite a bit in time, you know, all the way to the last ice age, even, you know, 12,000 BC, you know, 14,000 BC, there were people from Europe who were traveling to the Americas. Okay, so they knew the sea routes to get there. And that's why North America, you know, you have this mix of the Native Americans with Asian origins coming down from Alaska, from the Northwest. And then you have these ancient, they call them Silurian, who came from Europe, and they settled more of the East Coast. They went up the Mississippi and so on. And this was like 12,000 years ago. This is almost like Cro-Magnon level type stuff, right? And so I think these ancient global mariners might have been descendants of those, you know, these Silurian, Cro-Magnon people that already had knowledge of the Americas and everything like that. And they already had, you know, rudimentary global navigation stuff. So it's hard to say how far back, you know, this tradition ultimately goes. But and even in more recent history, you know, we have to look at their descendants. Who are their descendants? You know, their descendants include the Phoenicians, we got the Hittites, the Mitanni, Hyksos, the Iranians, the Indo-Aryans, the Celts, who else? Oh, the Dacians and the Thracians, Veneti, and so on, right? Now, the Thracians, especially, they're a people that lived right around, well, they lived during the time of Rome, okay? But they lived in the same region that the Vinca did thousands of years earlier. And so it's very likely that those were the same people, they're descendants, and that they probably continued the secret traditions that were laid out earlier by those super ancient mariners. And actually, there's some really interesting material out there on the Dacians and the Thracians, and how when Rome invaded their country, there was this kind of a stage show put on where Rome invaded the country and the country got taken over in a very short period of time, and pretty soon everyone was speaking Latin. But the thing is, it's not that they were speaking Latin, it's that the Dacians and the Thracians were already speaking a language from which Rome and Latin and everything originally came from, okay? So Rome basically invaded the secret occult power base that gave rise to them in the first place. And so the funny thing that happened was, when Rome did this, you know, invasion for show, the Romans pretty much fell to their knees in worship of the Dacians and the Thracians, because they realized, oh crap, these are the guys with the real power. These are the guys with the real hidden occult knowledge and really pulling the strings. So that part of history isn't mentioned too much, but there's some material on there. There's some documentaries on YouTube about it.
Makes me think of Brad Pitt in that film where he's a Greek god. I can't remember the name of the movie, but where these people do seem to have superhuman powers. And we clearly look at our history today and the people in charge and the people in our media, the Britney Spears and Madonnas of the world, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, I mentioned. And then you find they're all related to the Clintons, to the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and all go back to Vlad the Impaler. And they're proud and excited to tell you that they're all of the same bloodline. They promote it all over the place. So, you know, this could very well be that very bloodline that has a bit of knowledge going back. And I'm bringing us up to an end here, Tom, as we get to the end of this first hour. And I want to, you know, complete any thoughts you had, of course. But yeah, we're looking at a bloodline scenario here, folks, when we start to look at this puzzle and realize that we are dealing with another race, another species of beings when we start to look at the elite. And, you know, we need to take in all of this ancient knowledge, this ancient civilization, to realize what's happening on the stage with our current politics. But just before we get to our final thoughts on here, I want to remind everybody to check out montalk.net. That's MONTALK.net. And I mean, this is a deep, deep website. It's been up for years and years, you know, over a decade. It's got a ton of stuff. You want to check this out. I know Tom was around back in the good old days when the Freeman Perspective was still on the air. And boy, we almost had you on the TV show way back then. I'm so glad that you made it now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm glad to be on the show to talk about this subject, because, you know, most of the interviews that I do, they tend to be about you know, spiritual principles, you know, the alien deception and so on. But I've never really done one on this ancient history stuff, and yet I've been devoting, you know, like 50% of my time to researching it. So it's kind of cool to get to discuss something that I haven't really discussed before on a show. It's
fantastic.
Great to be doing.
Yeah. And we're definitely, folks, we're going to get much deeper into all of this, get into spiritual technology, demiurgic technology, as Tom has called it, get deep into the Ark of the Covenant and the extraterrestrial connection to our current religions and how this all plays together in a technology that is visible and occult all at the same time. So I hope that you will subscribe to FreemanTV.com, get all the great stuff that's coming out in the members section. It's getting long in there, great stuff. But of course, there's another 10 years of free stuff on FreemanTV.com that you definitely need to go check out. I mean, I work hard on it. I think Tom can attest to the webmastery is no joke. We work all day to get this to you, so please use the tools we're giving you. Get over to FreemanTV.com, dig deep in there, because there's a ton of stuff there that's not you know, hidden at all. But if you become a member, it's 23 cents a day. You're supporting our efforts. You're helping me bring more people to the surface. And it just keeps these things going, because also it's not free. So if anything, you know, kick in a tip at the end of the show. Toss me a buck. There's enough of you out there. A dollar would make a big difference. So just remember, you support this effort and you keep it all going. So just visit the website is a big deal. Go over to FreemanTV.com, check out everything it has to offer. And then if you're really into it, subscribe and get all the extra bonus material that we're bringing you. And there's going to be a lot more of that. So I hope you all will do this. You want to get out some final thoughts for our listening audience at this time?
Yeah, sure. I'll just quickly mention that when I was talking about these ancient mariners, I think their legacy lives on, and the plans that they set into motion are coming to their conclusion in the near future. I mean, they were the ones who founded Egyptian civilization. They were the ones who founded Mayan civilization. They founded, to some degree, the Chinese civilization and so on and so forth. So if we're going to talk about who's pulling the strings on this planet, we have to look at the ones who pulled them in the past, okay, who may still be pulling them today. So, you know, I'm talking about Druids, I'm talking about Thracians, Phoenicians, who are, you know, their descendants might be the ones who have the true power base today. But to take it one step further, it's not so much that they are the top of the pyramid, but they are merely proxies for alien factions who were the ones that gave them the key technologies and knowledge in the first place. And for all we know, those mariner bloodlines may have been human-alien hybrids, for all we know, you know, with superior mental abilities, which is why they were so good at math and geometry and memorizing thousands of lines of instructional poetry on astronomy and global navigation. But anyway, as much as I've said, that's still only scratching the surface. You know, there's a lot more that can be said, like about the Ark of the Covenant and the Great Pyramid and the Holy Grail and how all of that ties into it. So yeah, we'll definitely talk about that in the coming segment.
Yeah, all of that coming up in the second hour, folks. Get on over to freemantv.com and subscribe. It's worth it. You'll love it, I promise. And if you don't, you know, cancel. It's no big deal, no problem. You can get a week for free just by subscribing on PayPal and try it out and see if you like it or not. So yeah, we're gonna dig deep into the Holy Grail, folks, because this is hard on the topic. If you don't realize how much the topics of the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, the Philosopher's Stone have an impact on our current situation, well, you're not listening to enough Freeman. We've been covering this for a long time, so dig deep into the shows and find out more and more about it, because this is it. It's now, folks, and it's so important. So we're gonna move this on over into the members section. You all just thank you so much for tuning in and following us on all the streams out there on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and all those places. I do want to mention to you guys, I do have a website. so many times, Tom, I don't put the show up on YouTube, and I get all these comments saying, why aren't there any shows? Why aren't there any shows? And I'm like, well, they're all happening on my website. You know, I'll get them to YouTube as I will, but you know, it all happens right here, folks. That's what I'm saying. So get on over there and check it out. And we'll be right back.